Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is, for many of you, your favorite iteration of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast because it's our weekly Q&A with Layla, a very popular segment among our weekly offerings. Often we interview individuals who have made a major contribution to the world of nutrition or health, integrative medicine. But on a weekly basis, we talk to Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, who herself makes a daily contribution to the field of nutrition. And we field your questions. Your questions come to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. One word, radioprogram@AOL.com. And we have a deluge of questions coming into us. We answer them as expeditiously as possible. And if you keep on listening, you'll eventually hear your question answered, hopefully, if it is suitable for airing. We reserve the right to edit questions and to select among them. So how you doing, Layla?
I'm all right, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And you know, I want to congratulate you because one of your recent articles went through the roof. And that was the was an article or podcast on the subject of vitamin D and tanning. How much?
Article.
Yeah, article.
Yeah.
Right. I think you said to be followed up with an eventual podcast. But, man, we got a
podcast,
lot of hits on that
yes.
article. I posted it on Facebook, and literally thousands and thousands of people weighed in. Dozens of people shared it. So news you can use, especially.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it really resonated because this is the time of year where people start thinking about sun exposure.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I thought it was apropos. Yeah, yeah. So, and I'm following up with actually a two-parter podcast on vitamin D. Its role
Excellent.
In chronic disease. How much do we need? How do we get it? What keeps us from getting it, etc.
Okay. Well, lots of people very interested in the vitamin D issue. Lots of people the beneficiaries of some of the advice we've given them so far on vitamin D.
Yes.
And a thankful audience indeed. Thankful patients as well. All right, so before we get going, I'll just share an interesting article that I posted on Facebook that also got a lot of traction. Nutrient supplements can give antidepressants a boost. The way that I the way that I pitch this is that, I don't know if you, maybe this dates me because I don't think this product is still around, or maybe it is. Hamburger Helper. You know, when you didn't have enough hamburger, you know, you'd add some of this Hamburger Helper, which was God knows what the heck that stuff was. You know, maybe there was a little bit of isolated soy protein, maybe a little bit of sawdust, you know, maybe some methyl cellulose and unpronounceable things. But anyway, if you ran out of hamburger and you're trying to save money, you know, you could buy a package of Hamburger Helper. Antidepressants, as we know, don't always work. In fact, infrequently do they work like, you know, perfectly, right? You know, some people say, well, I get a little bit of a benefit. Some people not at all.
Usually, or the benefit is temporary.
Or the benefit is temporary. So obviously we need something, not necessarily in lieu of antidepressants, because I'm not inalterably opposed to antidepressants. I think some people have major serious depression issues that can't be combated with just diet, nutrition, and exercise and positive
That's
affirmation
true.
Alone. So this is a real deal. But what can you do to offer Hamburger Helper to the antidepressants that only work partially? And the answer comes to us from the University of Melbourne in Australia. Nutrient supplements can give antidepressants a boost. And the ones that they focus in on, although I can think of several others, are omega-3 fish oils, SAMe, which is S-adenosylmethionine, methylfolate, which we know about. We know about you know, the methyl donors. And, in fact, even the pharmaceutical companies are now offering something called Deplin, which is an add-on. It's pitched as an add-on to your SSRI medication. So say you're taking Zoloft, Paxil, Lexapro, and you want to get a little more bang for your buck, have a real slam dunk response, take a little bit of prescription folate. Well, Deplin. That's also available over the counter. Mm. Yeah. And vitamin D. Mm-hmm. We're all found to boost the effects of medication. This is from a meta-analysis in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Doesn't get any better than much better than that. And a journal that generally poo-poos the role of nutrition in depression. They also reported mixed results for zinc, vitamin C, and tryptophan. And by the way, folate worked better than folic acid. It said folic acid didn't work particularly well. So don't think, that cheap over-the-counter folic acid, old-fashioned folic acid, does not do the trick in terms of boosting the efficacy of the antidepressants in the study anyway.
It's got to be folate, as the folate found in our food.
Which is more expensive, a little harder to source, but, we offer a product called methylfolate. We also offer a product called MethylGuard, which also has a lot of B12. B12 may also be responsible for mood problems, particularly in the elderly.
Yeah.
And the B6 in there doesn't hurt. I really think B6 may play a role.
It doesn't hurt, and B6 is supposed to be helpful with anxiety.
Exactly.
So often, anxiety, depression, and anxiety go hand in hand.
Right. And if not B6, P5P, which seems to be sort of a more body-ready form of B6. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting, and you can read more about it on Facebook where I posted it. Or listen to a more comprehensive discussion of that, which I'm going to do on the weekend show coming up this weekend. All right. So let's take some questions.
Dr. Hoffman, we have a really nice note from a very happy listener.
Good.
If I may read it.
Indeed.
This is an email from Denise. Denise writes, "Settled in at bedtime, podcast downloaded, and headphones tucked under my pillow, I got a nice surprise. What a treat to hear my question discussed on the radio program." I guess it's because it's a podcast, but radio podcast, the lines are starting to blur, aren't they?
Exactly. I think, we really have Denise to sort of teach people, it's a new paradigm. I was with an older patient, he was in his 70s, and I was like, when is your radio program? And I said, you don't really have to be thinking about that, because our radio program, even if you miss it, we put it up as a podcast on Mondays. And plus,
that's right.
Where he's from, New York City, there's only 1 hour. You can listen to the full 2 hours by listening to the podcast. And he said, how do I do that? And I said, just go on your computer, use a computer, and just click. Go to drhoffman.com and click on the podcast. And like magic, my voice comes through the speakers on your computer. Good stuff. By the way, interesting is that the majority of people now listen to us via mobile devices. It just crossed the threshold of 50%. So a lot of people using their phones or their iPads, which are considered mobile devices. So a lot of people
not everybody's listening to music on the subway. They're listening to podcasts and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Or on that long drive, that boring drive, instead of listening to the stupid news with where they're looping the same stories and, hearing about, Donald Trump this and, Hillary Clinton that. And, it gets a little, it's a little tiresome after a while.
Anyway, Denise goes on to say, "Love all that you do, Dr. Hoffman, Layla, and your staff. I will keep listening and promoting your good work." Thank you, Denise, for that very kind note, and thank you for listening.
Great. Yeah. No. So, and she's she was rewarded by, she sent a question in, and she's like, nobody's ever going to bother, answering my question. But probably 2-3 weeks later, she was pleasantly surprised to hear her question fielded. So that's good.
Right. Okay. So, we've got a question from Pat, who writes, "My husband, Bob, considers himself a loser in the genetic lottery. He's 5 feet 11 inches and weighs only 140 pounds. His question to you is, why, after running and lifting weights for the last 25 years, has he seen no increase in the size of his arms and legs? Thank you for your excellent podcast, Pat."
Okay. So,
I wonder if he's taking in enough calories.
Right, number one. I mean, look, he's...
For one thing.
It's possible that he's just genetically programmed to be thin. I mean, there really is something to that. On the other hand,
his BMI is a 19.5, according to height and weight.
Right, which is below optimal, right? Which is, BMI of 21 or less.
19 and a half.
Oh, I see.
We like it between 19 and a half or 19, 19 and a half and 22.
Right. And then
18 and a half and below would be underweight. Yeah.
Right. So, I would say.
Would you wonder about his testosterone?
Absolutely. Bingo.
Yeah.
First thing I would think of is, especially as he grows older, he may have a lowered level of testosterone. And we actually saw this in a gentleman that we saw in the office this week who seemed very, very thin. And, my first impression was, gee, is he on some very restrictive raw foods, vegan diet? Why does he seem so thin? And the guy probably started out thin. He, when I spoke to him, he never said he was overweight. But he's lost weight because he's on a testosterone-blocking medication. Turns out he has prostate cancer, and he's on a medication that blocks testosterone. Well, actually, that can have two effects. It can make you chubby and fat, but it can also make you lose lean body muscle and develop sarcopenia. And with sarcopenia, you just don't have a lot of muscle mass. Now, the other thing this guy is doing is, if he really wants to concentrate on weight gain, lose the aerobic exercise, unfortunately. Because if he's...
That running, exactly.
See, what happens when you run is, it's interesting, the body wants to run efficiently. So if you keep stressing your body will adapt to running. Now, the perfect adaptation to running is not to have big muscles. It's to be really thin. You see the champion... marathoners from Kenya or Africa, they have virtually no upper body mass. They have like chicken chests, and they have really, 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 really skinny arms, and they actually have relatively thin legs, although they have powerful thighs and calves. But the ideal body configuration, if you're going to run, is very thin. I mean, I use running to sort of counteract the weight gain effects of strength training, because one time I did a little experiment. I just did strength training for a couple of years. I got a little bored of running. And I just did strength training, almost no aerobics. And I went up to like a size 42 jacket, which was unusual for me because I'm usually a perfect size 40. And so now that I'm picking up my running volume, doing a little more aerobic stuff and less strength training, I actually fit into a size 38 regular, which for the first time in my life, maybe the first time in my adult life, maybe I was more like that weight in college. So, it could be the exercise style. There could be some underlying malabsorption, too, and one might want to look at that.
Right. Well, we don't know what kind of diet Pat's husband Bob is on.
Right.
We don't know if he's vegan. We don't know if he's vegetarian. We don't know if he...
On a very low-fat diet.
Soy. We don't know if he's getting enough protein. Maybe he's on a low-fat diet. Exactly.
Right. And some people who listen to this program and are very health conscious, perhaps they don't listen lately because we've been pushing back against this for a long time, is they're still adhering to the low-fat dogma, which means that they might be calorically insufficient. They eat lots and lots of fiber. Okay, fine. But their caloric intake may not match their exertion if they're particularly athletic. So,
yes.
So this guy's fate may be to be thin because, just as overweight body type is hard to break the cycle on, it's even harder for thin individuals to gain weight. It's just
We do have a minority of patients who have that dilemma.
Yep.
And I'll tell you, it can be just as troubling for those who are overweight.
Right.
Trouble gaining weight is quite the dilemma to be.
Right. Well, it's just, if you had the old comic books when I was a kid, it was like they had the ads for Charles Atlas, where you a 98-pound weakling, and they showed some guy getting sand kicked in his face because the bullies came along on the beach and insulted his girlfriend, and he was a puny little runt, and wasn't able to fight back. So the after picture, he's like ripped and muscled, and he's on the beach, and he's defending the honor of his girlfriend. That was a theme, very popular theme in the 50s when I was growing up, is this notion of, needing to to bulk up.
What I would recommend then for Pat's husband is to, like you said, Dr. Hoffman, try stopping running and just do the weight training for, oh, let's say a month, maybe 2 months, and see where that goes.
Increase your intake of especially fats, because actually the limiting factor on muscle is not so much protein, it's calories. Because when you don't have adequate calories, you actually, in effect, burn muscle for fuel. So, and taking inordinate taking inordinate amounts of protein doesn't necessarily magically make your muscles bulge.
No,
this is the mistake that a lot of younger bodybuilders make. They buy these huge vats with pictures of these gigantic muscle builders. Usually, they've got to be on steroids to look that way, and they believe that by taking scoops and scoops and scoops of this protein that somehow it's going to go directly to their muscles. Well, no, you do use the protein for repair if you work out really hard.
Yeah.
But there's a point of diminishing returns beyond which the protein doesn't even get utilized.
Right. Or it just turns into excess blood sugar. And then those weight trainers are actually looking a little thick.
Yep. It can do that.
Just a little bit. Yeah. So, Pat, best of luck. Tell Bob what we talked about.
Right.
Okay. All right. We've got a question, an email from David. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you for sharing your knowledge and experiences with us for so many years. What is the difference between linseed oil and flaxseed oil? I'm finding inconsistent references on the internet, and I'm curious which one would be most beneficial. Thank you for your time and assistance. David, linseed oil is more for industrial use, use as paint thinner, maybe lubricant, or things like that, machinery. Flaxseed oil is food-based and meant for, oral consumption.
Right.
For some of its beneficial omega-3s, anyway. So that's really the difference. You don't want to go... You know, if you find linseed oil at your health food store, which you likely won't, it's really flaxseed oil you would be looking for. And when you use flaxseed oil out of the bottle, you never want to cook with that. That is meant to be used as a dressing in your salad or to take as an oral supplement, a teaspoon, a tablespoon, whatever the dosage per.
Right.
So that would be the difference. You know, so if you're painting your house, linseed oil would be appropriate.
Right. Well, I think it's more in the oil paints that painters use. I'm not an artist, but I think that it almost smells a little like flax oil when you get oil paints. And oil-based paints are often mixed with linseed or, but maybe that isn't food grade. And
right.
So the other thing about flaxseed oil is I generally prefer fish oil for supplementation, but if you're going to take flax oil, say you're a vegan vegetarian, you don't want to take animal-sourced omega-3. Flaxseed oil is a source of both omega-6 and omega-3, but it is high in alpha-linolenic acid, which is a precursor to EPA and DHA, if your body has the ability to convert it. And some people do and some people don't.
Now, 70% of us don't.
Yes.
And so I think a better vegetarian source would be from algae.
Yes, which is the DHA from algae.
Rather than flax oil, right. I think.
The one nice thing about flax oil is that you can get what's called lignin-rich flax oil. And the lignins actually are the more helpful part of the flax oil. They have nothing to do with... essential fatty acids. They are actually compounds which are enterolactones, which help to convert hormones in a helpful way, in effect detoxifying your body from excess levels of harmful hormones that may drive hormone related cancers.
And I wonder if over time, say a vegetarian or vegan is taking flaxseed oil because they're not having any fish, I wonder if over decades that they would naturally select to utilize it more beneficially.
This reminds me, there is an article that states that precisely that, which is that vegetarians have evolved to have a more effective conversion of the omega-3 precursors to EPA and DHA. However, there's a disadvantage associated with that because once they are able to do that, they also have the tendency to convert the omega-6 precursors, linoleic acid, to arachidonic acid, which is pro-inflammatory. Mm. And so this is an evolutionary adaptation which can go haywire and, in effect, create more pro-inflammatory drive in vegetarians, especially if they end up consuming too much omega-6 oil, which nowadays is more likely than it was, you know, in prehistoric times, because we get plenty and plenty of omega-6 vegetable oils, so many different sources. So it's an example of it's an example of a pathway that is beneficial in some respects by helping to synthesize the good omega-3 fats, but also promotes the synthesis of the bad omega-6 fat, arachidonic acid. That just came out recently as a study. So, and it's a transgenerational thing. It's partly natural selection, but it's partly what's called epigenetics, which is that you turn on and turn off genes by what you're doing, and that may be passed on to future generations. So there's a passing on sometimes of diabetes risk in people who've undergone starvation in subsequent generations. There's also a passing along of certain psychological traits in people who've had PTSD, which is the terrible tragedy of modern-day warfare, is that people in Syria, people in the Congo, people in Sudan who are subject to these horrible, horrible atrocities, that not only are they traumatized, but future generations unborn may be traumatized by what's happening to their genes. That's a scary thing.
Wow. Wow. Fascinating.
Yep.
All right. Well, David, we veered off a little bit, but thank you very much for your very thoughtful question.
You're a musician, right, Layla?
Uh-huh.
And you know what this means. We tend to riff a little bit, right? You know, it's kind of like a it's like, you know, we're not just playing the notes in the songbook. Sometimes we will riff on nutritional themes.
Uh-huh.
So consider that our last riff of the first part of today's Q&A with Layla. We promise to answer more questions more expeditiously in part two and stay on track. So stay with us. Part two coming up. And what will we be talking about in part two?
Is my bone broth a source of lead?
Okay. Provocative question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla, part of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast series.